afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much for your company. Stan Turner here. It's 12:06 on a, well, it's an overcast Saturday, is it not? October the 12th today, the forecast, you just heard it, not too bad, all things considered. A lot of you folks, including yours truly, are kind of bent on going out and catching the colors right now before all that stuff blows off the trees. The winds have been brisk, so might be a good idea to do what the New Englanders call leaf peeping today. I think that's what it's called. Hi, how you doing over there, my friend? George?
I'm doing well, sir, and
all
you?
All right, very good indeed. Yeah, I don't see any sun out your window. I can barely see from here.
Overcast right now.
It is indeed. I'm just going to take a quick peek at the Twin Cities just to reiterate. I don't like that word, but to repeat what we just heard here. Mostly cloudy skies today. A high maybe near 56. We're almost there already. And yeah, the winds are kicking up, gusting at times to 30 miles per hour. So there you have it. We have a show for you. Before we get into the main event here, I must tell you that we collectively and individually have lost yet another great friend. George, this is a guy you and I had the honor of knowing for several years.
Yes.
His name, Joe Gomer. He's the last of Minnesota's Tuskegee Airmen from World War II. Joe was among that noble band of blacks who, despite the prejudice of the time back in World War II, actually got air training and got into combat and piled up a distinguished record in the European theater of operations. Before World War II, there were many who said that blacks did not have the intelligence or the ability or the agility to fly an aircraft, and many people believed that. Of course, the nonsense of that was tipped over quickly when the blacks were allowed to get in those cockpits and show what they could do. Joe Gomer was a wonderful guy. Remember, George, he's very low-key.
Definitely.
If he was bitter about the experience, he didn't let that bubble to the surface. He lamented that things were the way they were, and he said that really becoming an airman was one way of helping desegregate this country.
True.
At the time. And ironically, he said that, by the way, the guy flew 68 combat missions. He flew the hottest fighter aircraft of the day, the P-47 Thunderbolt and the P-51 Mustang. He got all shot up one time by a German aircraft, but he survived. Had to crash land another time, and he survived. Amazing guy. But he said, actually, it was the Germans who ironically integrated the American armed forces, because when Americans were taken prisoner of war, the Germans threw them in the same barracks, blacks and whites alike. And he said that was the first...
Yeah.
First step in integrating the American servicemen. Interesting that. There is a life-size bronze statue of a young Joe Gomer. Joe Gomer died just the other day, I think yesterday, at the age of 93. But there is, if you go to the Duluth International Airport, a fine bronze statue, life-size, of a young Joe Gomer in his flying suit. And there is an inscription, a quote from Joe himself. It reads, "We're all Americans. That's why we chose to fight. I'm as American as anybody. My black ancestors were brought over against their will to help build America. My German ancestors came over to build a new life. And my Cherokee ancestors were here to greet all the boats." Isn't that interesting? Duluth Mayor Don Ness issued a statement on Joe's passing, noting that Joe Gomer was able to witness the unveiling of that statue. He called Gomer a national hero who had been an integral part of the community of Duluth ever since he moved there way back in the 60s. The Joe Gomer Monument, says the mayor, will forever serve as a reminder of Joe's vast contributions to our community and country. Another statue of Joe, by the way, was unveiled earlier this year in his hometown of Iowa Falls, Iowa. Joe stayed in the military for a time after the war. He retired with the rank of major, and he went on to join the National Forest Service, and that was his life's career. He once related how a fourth grader asked him why he fought so hard for a country that treated him so poorly. "I had to explain to him that this is my country. It's the only country I knew, and I was ready to sacrifice for it," said Joe Gomer. So, what a guy. What an American. George, as I recall, at least until recent years, there were three former Tuskegee Airmen living in Minnesota.
Okay.
Colonel Ken Wofford, we had him on the show a long time ago. Vernon Hopgood, I think his name was. I think he came from Iowa, but he was here at the Air Expo shows Flying Cloud. And then, of course, Joe Gomer, as we say, was a major. We're going to miss that guy very much. He was so low-key, so elegant.
Yep.
When he opened his mouth, he always had something of substance to say, and it was usually tinged with with a bit of sarcasm and humor, too. I mean, for the moment.
Yes.
Good guy. So, Joe Gomer, rest in peace. Thank you for all of your many contributions to all of us Americans. 12:11 right now, 54 degrees. Well, people in Minnesota and Wisconsin are big readers. Book sales are unusually high in both states. The past year or so has seen a bounty of good books from which to choose, be you a fiction lover or a fan of nonfiction. To my mind, two books stand out in the nonfiction category, and they truly deserve our attention in these times of government gridlock, stalemate, finger-in-your-eye politics, okay? One on my suggested must-read list is called Minnesota's Miracle, Learning from the Government That Worked. It's authored by Tom Berg, who served in the Minnesota legislature back in the 1970s when Republicans and Democrats joined hands to solve problems. Doesn't that sound quaint?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, the other book is titled American Politics in the Age of Ignorance, Why Lawmakers Choose Belief Over Research. That one is authored by David Schultz, professor of business at Hamline University in St. Paul. But David is deeply into politics, and he knows a ton about law. He is the go-to guy on this stuff. Professor Schultz, we'll call him David this hour, is our in-studio guest, head cold and all. David has a remarkable and admirable way of cutting through all the blather and the baffle gab that we hear daily, coming from many of our elected and government officials. David, welcome back, and nice to see you again.
Thank you. And baffle gab, I like as a new word.
Yeah, well, it's been out there a while.
All right, I haven't heard it. Okay.
Feel free to use it.
Okay.
Just attribute the sorts. I stole it from somebody else.
Okay,
too. You
good.
Know that. Okay,
okay, good.
Well,
okay.
David Schultz, you're just back from Gridlock Central, aren't you?
I was.
Washington, D.C.
I was. I was in a conference for a professional association for professors of public affairs, and we were in Washington, D.C. from Wednesday until late last night, and I can tell you that the city was dead.
Wow.
Dead in the sense that, well, of course it was raining cats and dogs to start with, which crab right off the street. But what was happening is that the hotel that I was at was right next to the headquarters for Housing and Urban Development, HUD. Yeah. That whole area there, absolutely dead. The streets were dead.
It shut down.
The whole city shut down. And I went to a couple of restaurants for dinner, and they were literally, I would say, I'm guessing, 10% occupied in terms of the restaurants.
Oh.
I mean, it was not quite to the point where they were saying, just come in, buy something, but it was close to that.
Wow.
And so this was the proverbial, you can go bowling in parts of Washington,
wow,
D.C. in the
wow.
streets
in
right
the
now.
Streets, not the alleys. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, David, what's the talk in the streets there right now? What are people saying? You're among academics, but did you talk to any, average Joes or Jones on the street?
Well, I talked to a lot of different people, not just the academics, but some average people.
You got to stay away from those academics sometimes.
Oh, yeah. Sure, you got to do like that. Okay, okay. The average people, of course, are just mad. They're just really livid about the fact that the government is shut down, and of course, how it's affecting their businesses. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
But in terms of that, there is sort of this sense of, I'm not sure if it's optimism or pessimism. I'll describe it in the sense that they think it's going to get solved. That is, government's going to reopen, but it's not going to come until probably close to the October 17th deadline, which is the deadline for having to solve the debt limit deal. So
that's Thursday.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So okay. So they're all sort of thinking by sometime later this coming week, things are going to reopen.
Okay.
But in the process, though, they're hurting. They're really hurting at this point in terms of the regular businesses.
We don't think about the restaurants and all the rest, especially in that town. That's a government town all the way.
We don't. I was in an area, the Galleria area, which is a really nice area that was renovated. It used to be 20 years ago, you wouldn't want to be caught dead there, let alone alive there. It was a horrible area. And it's been revitalized. It's an exciting, wonderful area, Washington, D.C. now. And on any given night, it's usually just like mob, just absolute mob.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, I would say, there were people on the streets, a few people in the restaurants, but it certainly wasn't the way that you would normally expect it, and certainly wasn't what the businesses wanted.
Oh, my. Well, we have twin stalemates, don't we?
We have
the quest for a continuing resolution, so-called CR, right? That keeps the federal, that reopens the government.
That's right,
Keeps it going. And you mentioned Thursday's deadline for raising the debt ceiling so government can borrow the operating money that it needs, okay?
Right.
Congress is in session right now. They've been meeting. This is the second Saturday in a row trying to do this thing. Attention focused on the Senate efforts to end the twin stalemates. We just heard on the news here just before we started that the Senate, has nixed any idea that, right. that was before them. I guess a Democratic idea. So where are we? We're like nowhere right now.
We're really nowhere at this point. Yep. But again, I think there are some possibilities for deals.
Yep.
The possibilities for deals emerge in a couple of areas.
Okay.
One of them is that what we're starting to see is the Republicans, well, actually, I'll talk about why we're getting to the possibilities.
All right.
Okay. The reason why we're getting towards the possibilities is, first, is public opinion polls are coming out at this point and are increasingly showing that both sides, it's pox on both sides.
Really?
But there's no question that at this point that the Republicans in the House are taking the brunt, the absolute brunt of the attack, where I think now what they have the lowest approval ratings ever since they've ever done this, ever done approval ratings of Congress. I think cockroaches are widely more popular at this now, and bed bugs are probably more popular too. And so it's a question of the fact that they're not getting their message out. They're very unpopular. Both sides are feeling like they have to do something because both sides are the American public doesn't like at this point. So I think that's one. Second, I think the pressure's coming from citizens. Mm-hmm. Pressure's coming from the business community because the chambers of commerce and businesses want things open. That's very important to note here because the House Republicans, who you normally think is friends of the business, are being pressured hugely by business. And so a lot of things are coming together. And then also we're starting to see now, as a result, language shifting away from saying that they're not going to open government or the deal's not going to be struck because it's all about Obamacare. We're starting to see something else happen in terms of other bargaining chips being thrown out. And that is, I think, where the basis is starting to occur. And where I think the bargaining chip, one of the bargaining chips going to occur, is actually going to be something that involves the state of Minnesota. And where that bargaining chip is going to be is over the tax on medical devices that's used to help pay for the Affordable Care Act, i.e. Obamacare. Now, in the state of Minnesota, our entire delegation is unified, Republicans and Democrats, to want to repeal that tax because this affects Medtronic and our biomedical industry. There's now talk in Congress of saying that, okay, what Obama might be willing to give up, even though he said he doesn't want to negotiate, he might be willing to give up the tax on medical devices in return for some other things. And there's, again, that's part of the debate. The other part of the debate is saying, okay, a temporary reopening of the government or a temporary lifting of the debt deal.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're starting to see the contours of something. And I'll just say, I don't know, I'll shut up for a second here.
No, please, go.
What I wish I could have on the radio, and I don't have it, maybe you have a sound effect for it that you can have here, is the sound effect of somebody kicking a can. Okay.
Yeah. And down the road.
Down the road, exactly.
Or the sound of a Band-Aid
or
being
something
applied.
Right, applied to something
right,
like that.
Right.
And when people ask, well, why are we where we are now?
Right.
It's because we have Band-Aided or we've kicked the can down the road several times, and what we're going to probably do on this one is kick it down the road again to probably around October of 2014.
Same old, same old, same old. It really never gets solved, does it?
That's exactly the issue here, is that it partly doesn't get solved because I think what we have now is this enormous gulf between both, first, the Republicans and Democrats on a whole host of issues in terms of really comes down to not just Obamacare, but over a really basic question, why government? Why should we even have government? And I think that's a huge gulf there. But the second gulf that's really emerged, which is even more fascinating.
Did you say why have government?
Yes, why have government? Exactly.
Let's hear it for anarchy.
well, in part, it's all about how much government do we really need?
Yeah. True. That's right.
That's really part
legitimate
of the debate.
Question.
It's a very legitimate question. But the bigger debate, I think, is not so much between the Republicans and Democrats. It's between, I would say, the Republicans who were in the House of Representatives in 1995, 96, the last time there was a shutdown versus sort of the Tea Party Republicans who weren't there and the older
who were not there.
Okay. The older, right. Yeah. Again, apologies for being a little nasally.
That's
today.
Okay. Right. I'll translate, David.
That's okay. And the older guard that was there before Republicans in 95 saw how the shutdown really hurt them as Republicans and didn't want to go this direction again versus the sort of the Tea Party Republicans, including Michelle Bachmann, who sort of feel like, well, it's worth taking the shutdown. It's worth going in that direction. And so it's a battle, really, I think, as much as within the Republican Party as it is a battle between the Republicans and Democrats.
Let's talk about the Democrats. Obviously, the polls, the rest show that the Republicans, especially House Republicans, taking a lot of heat on this, these twin stalemates. What about the Democrats? They've got to have some culpability here, too, don't they? Well, I mean, they could be doing some things better, couldn't they?
Well, they could be doing some things better. And I think it starts with Obama in terms of the strengths and weaknesses of his bargaining position. The strength of his bargaining position was in the sense of him saying, I'm going to take no prisoners. I'm not going to negotiate. I'm just going to hold fast and make it because I don't want to negotiate over the budget, over the debt limit. And in part, that's a good strategy to force the Republicans to give, banking on the fact that the shutdown will affect them. The bad part about it is that it also has made him look like he's not willing to move also. It makes it look like he's intransigent and he's unwilling to compromise. And the Republicans have been counting on the fact that maybe at some point public opinion would start to say, well, look, Obama's not negotiating. So that's one issue. Mm-hmm. The second thing is the fact that some of my friends would argue, and I think there's truth to this, that in part we're where we are today because Obama hasn't been the best bargainer, hasn't been the best negotiator, and he has been willing to give a lot in the past, and therefore the Republicans have felt like, well, heck, they could just kind of push him around, and he's going to give in. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a combination of him both being a not a very good bargainer. He doesn't like doing this. He's not a Lyndon Johnson.
You have to be, don't you?
You have to be. You have to wheel deal.
Yes.
I mean, the essence. Richard Neustadt said this 50 years ago in his great book, Presidential Power. Said it's the power to persuade. It's the power to negotiate, to convince people. And Obama's just not been a very good negotiator. Right. And so I fault the Democrats and Obama for not being a good negotiator, and at the same time, at least making it look like you're not willing to negotiate and not willing to sort of make it set up a scenario where that the Republicans can walk away saying they got some bone out of this.
Wow. Professor David Schultz, well, professor of so many things at Hamline University in the business school. I think you're still there in that aspect, but
actually, I am in the political science department now.
You moved over now.
Moved over.
All right. A man on the move, a moving target here.
That's right.
So
that's
political
right.
Science, where I think you belong, but I know you know a lot about business.
Sure.
And law, too,
right.
Of course. David Schultz, our guest here. We're going to take a break, George. We'll be back with trying to sort out, blow the smoke away, clear away the baffle gab, David.
All right.
Sure. We're going to do that here, and we're doing our best to steer a nonpartisan course here, because this is not about favoring one side or the other. It's just trying to explain why we are where we are and how we get out of this mud hole.
Yep.
So we'll be right back. I'm Stan Turner with exciting news for book lovers. Downtown Stillwater has just completed its new pedestrian walkway next to Valley Bookseller. Park right next to the store, then enjoy your new books out on the deck or on Stillwater's new patio overlooking the St. Croix. Valley Bookseller is indeed the Twin Cities' most beautiful bookstore. Great books, great people, great view. 217 North Main in Stillwater. Online at valleybookseller.com.
The 1920s were a golden age for baseball and custom-tailored clothing. That golden age is back at Jaime's Haberdashery in St. Paul. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Make each visit uniquely yours with hats, suits, casual wear, and accessories. Visit their barbershop for a hot lather shave. It's the golden age again at Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at jaimes.com.
I want to be an artist.
I'm going to be a dancer or a sewer like my mommy.
I'm going to be a fireman.
But first you have to quit sucking your thumb.
All of you are important to America, and if you work hard, you can be anything you want to be. God has a plan and a mission just for you.
He does.
That's right, and that's why you are America's greatest natural resource. Hello, my name is Marianne Kuharski, and I'm the director of Pro-Life Across America, the Billboard People. If you know someone who is pregnant or in need of information or would like to support the life-saving work of Pro-Life Across America, please call 1-800-366-7773 or visit our website at prolifeacrossamerica.org. Pro-Life Across America, educational and non-political.
I can suck my thumb before I was even born.
We are back here. It's 1225. What do we have? 54 cloudy degree. Can degrees be cloudy? I guess they can be. It's 54, whatever it is. And we may top out today. Not much more than that. 56 degrees. The winds will be kicking up there. Hang on to your little headgear there. Gusting at times to 30 miles per hour. We have some pretty good wind gusts going in the studio right now because we're talking about these twin stems. That's not about you, Dave.
Oh,
I'm
okay.
Just talking. No, no, no. I'm the gas bag, not you.
Oh, I thought.
we are moving the, making the air move around here because we are talking about these twin stalemates in Washington right now affecting all of us. David Schultz, professor of political science, among other good things, at Hamline University in St. Paul. David's just back. Got back last night from Washington, D.C., where there's kind of an eerie silence. It's really weird, isn't it? Even the restaurants are not doing it.
Even the restaurants. And we were supposed to do a couple of receptions, one at the Rayburn Building, which, is closed.
Yep.
And then we were going to go to the Botanical Gardens. That, of course, was closed, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so everything is shut down. Everything is literally shut down at this point. And so without the federal workers and without the tourists, small businesses and all businesses alike are hurting. And so the message to Congress is, get the deal done, because you're not just hurting the American public, you're also hurting the small businesses.
We could be more blunt about it, but then we're on the air right now.
That's right.
We have an FCC license here. We don't want to say that. But I remember a St. Paul attorney who had a wonderfully sardonic, but there was some truth to it. He talked about our own Minnesota legislature back when they were in gridlock, and they often were and are.
Right.
He said, you know what we ought to do, only half in earnest or half serious? He said, we ought to pay our lawmakers only on the days they do not meet. Now, think about the wisdom of that, huh?
Yeah.
They wouldn't be up there to do maybe mischief
often, huh? Right.
And they'd be having incentive to stay home.
Right. Well, we'll keep in mind on one thing regarding this whole partial governmental shutdown.
Right.
Congress is getting paid.
It is, isn't it?
Because they are considered essential governmental employees.
Some people may... I can hear some people laughing at that
exactly,
right now.
Yes, exactly.
Indeed, yeah. Some of them are giving their paychecks to charity, and some are taking them, right? So, I don't know.
Exactly. But the people who are causing the problem are also the ones who are not paying the price.
That's right. Thank you. That's exactly right. And as you say, a lot of polls indicate a pox on both your houses, both the Democrats and the Republicans, taking heat for this thing, and it's got to get done. It's got to get settled here. Thursday... What happens? Is this hyperbole we're hearing? If we don't raise the debt ceiling by Thursday, will there be dire economic consequences for us and the global economy?
Yes. Okay. Now, there are some people who are saying that there will not be, but we run out of money. And what we have to do at that point is to figure out who we're going to pay. And here's the dilemma, is that, yes, we're going to be bringing in money on a daily basis still, you know, through tax revenues and so forth, but we're certainly not going to be able to meet certain obligations. And one of the first choices that we're going to have to decide as a country, if we don't do the debt obligation, raise the debt limit on the 17th, is, do we pay our foreign creditors, or does grandma get her Social Security check?
Whoa.
And both of them have enormous implications, because obviously we should give grandma her Social Security check.
Well, that's in a trust fund, though, David. That money doesn't come out of the cookie jar, does it?
That's not segregated funds. We borrow from that money.
We do.
We borrow from it.
Okay, I wanted to clarify that. That's scary.
Contrary to all those talk about a decade ago that said it's in a lockbox, it's not in a lockbox. And so we borrow from the Social Security Trust Fund. And revenues come in. Revenue, as the money comes in, we're paying out. And so it's not like people have this image that they think that, okay, they have Social Security withholdings. It goes into a separate account, separate box, and nothing gets touched. That also explains why many... This is a long-winded answer, by the way.
That's okay.
This also explains why when people sometimes say, well, we're not getting very much interest on the deposits from the Social Security trust funds. Well, it's because these are all short-term deposits. These are not long-term deposits. It's not like you or I setting up a 401k.
Right.
It sits there for 20, 30 years or something like that. So, yes. So we have to decide right off the bat, does grandma get the Social Security check, or do we pay our foreign bondholders and creditors, including People's Republic of China, Japan, Great Britain, so forth like that? Both of them are equally important. The argument is that if we don't pay our foreign creditors, for example, then the enormous amount of interest that we're going to have to pay in terms of interest rates going up is going to be just huge. And so we're faced with an incredibly dire set of circumstances, of which I would not want to have to make that choice. Does grandma get the check, or does the Bank of China get the check?
Well, I could see a peasants' revolt coming among the good burghers of this country if they don't get their Social Security. They're going to sharpen their pitchforks, I think, right?
Oh, they will. I think, as one of my neighbors used to say, they will be fit to be tied. There's no question about it. But the question will be then, will this affect politics in 2014, and will people remember? And that will be the really interesting question.
Okay, that's the big political question. David, your book, it's been out for a few months, had you on the air here on this show last February. American Politics, you call it. This is the title of David's book. His latest book, he has a lot of them. American Politics in the Age, not of Innocence, but the Age of Ignorance.
Right.
What's the basic thrust of the book? Let's just review it quickly.
Okay, the basic thrust of the book is to talk about, as the subtitle says, what lawmakers don't know. And what I'm really interested in is sort of a phenomenon that I've noticed over my career of watching the same type of legislation reenacted over and over and over again, only to see it fail continuously. And I'm always interested in why do we keep reenacting failed legislation, or why are we captured by political myths, especially when we have incredibly good evidence based upon scientific research, social scientific research, or just good old-fashioned, we've tried it before. Mm-hmm. Why do we keep repeating failed public policies? Originally, I wanted to call them stupid public policies, but my publisher said you can't use that word. And so I said, okay, I'll change it.
You can use it here if you want to.
But why do we keep enacting things that we know are going to fail? Right. And that's the whole premise of the book, is to try to both first explain why we keep reenacting, I'll even change it, dumb ideas. Why do we keep pushing dumb ideas? And then B, do we have a catalog of some of the more frequent ideas that we know fail, but yet nonetheless keep reenacting them? And that's what the book is about.
Why do we, the body politic, keep coming back to failed ideas?
Well, I list three sets of broad reasons. One is at the individual level. At the individual level, it's sometimes a combination of the fact that public officials either willfully turn a blind eye to the facts, they don't really grasp or understand how to actually interpret the information that's there, or they don't have the time or energy to do it. And so one, it's about individual capacity. Second level, I call it's the political level, that we have increasingly partisan political polarization. Say that three times quickly. Partisan political polarization.
I did it with a cold.
That prevents individuals in the legislature or Congress from actually being able to look at the merits of proposals. And then third, what we have are what I call structural factors. That is the role of money in politics, special interest politics, that all come together to reinforce and make it difficult for legislators to act upon the best evidence at hand. And I always point out to people, and every time I give a talk about my book, everybody shakes their heads and agrees, and I says, think about it in our own private life. Except for when we go play the lottery, go play the ponies at Canterbury, we're all taught to make our decisions best based on what? The best evidence at hand. And that's what we should be doing in politics also. But yet, that doesn't always happen. And that's what the whole premise of the book is, again, to say that because of these individual, because of these political and structural factors, oftentimes decisions are made where choices are made where they're not based upon the best evidence at hand, but on a whole bunch of other factors.
Let's talk about some of these, what you might call myths in your books and failed policies. You call it sports fair.
Sports fair.
That's an interest. This ties into the stadium.
It does.
Weren't we told a year or so ago that we're done financing these monopolistic enterprises with public money? I mean, after all, a sports stadium is owned by a legal monopoly, basically, isn't
it? That's right.
Okay. So public money is now pouring into the new Viking stadium. And again, I'm not anti-football. I'm not anti-Vikings. Not at all. Not anti-Packers. Just we're the Packers station.
That's right. Okay. That's right. Of course.
But you know, here we go. Digging into the public's pocket again.
Right.
When many of our leaders, our esteemed public leaders on both sides, said they weren't going to do it. They did it.
Okay.
So this is going to help us economically, they say. Right.
The Viking Stadium is a great example of sort of a couple of problems. One is that we know overwhelming research that one of the worst public investments that you can make for economic development purposes is public subsidies for sports stadiums. In terms of jobs produced, types of jobs produced, impact on the economy, truly horrible investment right off the bat. And so we shouldn't be doing it for that purpose. Second, you can make sort of an argument to say that these are private businesses. Essentially, sports teams are private businesses that have monopolies, and that like any other private business, they should be able to survive on their own or not. But there's a different wrinkle with the Viking Stadium I also want to point out here, too. We might recall during the legislative debates, someone said, well, if we do charitable pull tabs, we'll generate $35 million a year to be able to pay for part of the public subsidy for the stadium. Well, after a year, we found out it was less than $1 million a year. And now we know, where did that estimate of $35 million
Where?
Come from? It came from the vendors who were going to sell the equipment to the state of Minnesota to run to run these poll tabs. And at no point along the line did legislators, did anybody
either party,
involved,
of either,
either
party
right. okay. stand up and say, where did we get this million, our $35 million estimate from?
Right, right.
None whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Now, I'll even, so that's a great example of turning a blind eye to think, so they wanted to make a deal done. Now, I'll turn to something else.
Yes.
To fix it, this last legislative session, they said that, okay, what they're going to do, among other things, is a one-time tax on internet sales.
Oh,
cigarettes and internet
cigarettes
sales.
Cigarettes, too.
They're going to do cigarettes. Cigarettes, of course. Okay. Now, that's going to
always
take,
cigarettes.
Always cigarettes. But they also were going to place a tax on internet sales to be able to generate this. Well, as soon as they did that deal, Amazon.com said that, okay, the businesses that we used to use in Minnesota for Amazon.sales, of which you could then sales tax on, we're not going to use anymore. That source of revenue is going to dry up, too. I am convinced we will be back at the legislature in about another year having to do yet another fix on this.
Oh, man. Well, we saw a story in the papers just this week that the $975 million for the stadium will not be enough.
Right.
That they're going, the builders and the sports authority, going to have to cut back some of the quote-unquote amenities. So no escalator up to the top level of the stadium, no 400-whatever-it-is car parking ramp adjoining the stadium, that sort of thing. So I can just see the hands coming out already next session saying, we really do need more money from the public purse.
We do, we do. Yeah. And the thing is, I'm going to put on my other hat.
Okay.
In my previous life before being a professor, I was a city director of code enforcement back east. I used to enforce city and state housing, building, and construction laws. I actually know a little bit about construction at this point as a result of that. Just enough to be dangerous. And I say this because when this project was proposed, I could have bet, you know, the contents of my wallet and said there will be cost overruns and they've underestimated the price. And it's sure enough, that's exactly what's happened. And so we know that's going to happen. The other couple of stories about the stadium, which are great to get out, and I say great with all sarcasm, is now the licensing fee that are going to go on the seats for people who are going to be paying thousands of dollars for. And why that's important is because there's this myth. There's this myth that Ziggy Wolf is paying half of the cost for the stadium. He's not. He is going, by the time he gets the loans from the NFL, by the time he soaks the fans and everything, his personal contribution is about $36 million.
Wow.
The state's going to put up about $500 million. He's going to get money of about $500 million from other sources. So think about that. He spends, I'll throw in one other figure. He has spent about $10 million over the last half dozen years lobbying the state legislature. So a $10 million investment plus $36 million of his own pocket yields $1 billion return. God, I wish I could get that kind of return on my investment. And that's what he's going to get. And he's going to get most of that money out of where? Out of the fans and out of taxpayers.
And a new stadium, what does that do to the overall worth price of his NFL team?
What it's going to do, it'll probably increase the price by 40 or 50%. It's going to dramatically increase it. And at that point, what we usually find is that most owners of teams, they usually sell their team within a couple of years after getting a new stadium because the price has gone up by 40%. I anticipate something similar to that.
Sell high.
Now, there may be some clawback provisions here, but the fact is Ziggy's going to walk away making a ton of money.
Well, it is 12:39 here. Let me take a deep breath. Wow, David, that's really some information. Again, we are not anti-football. It's just we're exploding some myths here along the way and getting the numbers right.
Right, you know, since this is the station of the Packers, we can point to the Packers example.
Let's do that.
The Packers example of having a municipally owned stadium that the people own, and guess what? It still makes money.
Yeah. Sold stock, is that how they do it?
Yep. They sold stock.
And they're doing well. They have a pretty good team, too.
They have a great team.
Yep. They're going to be on the air here tomorrow, aren't they, Joe? Yep.
Yes, sir, they are.
Oh, boy. Who is this guy who is talking to us right now and really got our attention? Is David Schultz, professor of political science, law, and business at Hamline University in St. Paul. We have much more to talk with David. It's 12:40. We have 54 degrees. We'll be back right after this. To really experience a book, meet the author. I'm Stan Turner for Valley Bookseller in downtown Stillwater. Every month, Valley Bookseller's calendar is loaded with events featuring both local and national authors. Visit valleybookseller.com and click the events calendar for a complete list. Choose from monthly events like the Totally Criminal Cocktail Hour or special presentations with authors on tour. Meet your favorite author at Valley Bookseller. Great books, great people. 217 North Main in Stillwater.
The 1920s were a golden age for baseball and custom-tailored clothing. That golden age is back at Jaime's Haberdashery in St. Paul. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Make each visit uniquely yours with hats, suits, casual wear, and accessories. Visit their barber shop for a hot lather shave. It's the golden age again at Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at Jaime's.com.
For weeks now, I've been telling you about Scandia Shores of Shoreview, the independent senior living community with the perfect location. Right near everything, shops, doctors, restaurants. You've heard me tell you about the caring staff and how friendly and attentive they are. I've gone on and on about the beautiful and spacious apartments at Scandia Shores. And the food. Ah, I can't tell you enough about how many people rave about the food. Now it's time to see for yourself. Scandia Shores of Shoreview invites you to an open house Friday, October 18th from 1:30 to 3:30. There will be tours, refreshments, and special deals for new renters. On Saturday, October 19th, a second open house from 3 to 5 p.m. More tours, plus an ice cream social. Scandia Shores of Shoreview at Highway 96 and Hodgson Road, the area's most exceptional independent senior living community. The open houses are Friday, October 18th and Saturday, October 19th. Call 651-415-9793 for more information. 651-415-9793. Scandia Shores of Shoreview.
We are back, and the air is charged as we talk here about politics, stadiums, the whole mess in Washington. We may have some messes here in Minnesota, too. A lot of people think so. David Schultz, professor of politics, of law, and business at Hamline University, author of several books, the latest being, I think it's the latest, David, American Politics in the Age of Ignorance. D-d-d. Where do we get the book? People want to read it.
You can go to Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. I tell people that it's cheaper to buy an electronic copy than it is a hard copy, but either will be fine. I make no more money with a hard copy as opposed to an electronic copy.
Schultz, S-C-H-U-L-T-Z. First name, David, and we've been dishing on stadiums and all the rest of it, saying that Green Bay might be a great model for communities to emulate when it comes to paying for stadiums.
It is, because you never have to worry about Green Bay Packers threatening to get up and leave and go somewhere else.
Right.
We've had the Flambeau Field, which has been there for, like, forever.
Right.
And we just don't have to worry.
Right.
And the community is invested in the team. They sell stock. It works out to be a very good model.
Mm-hmm. What else? Let's see. Myths we've been talking about. So stadiums do not have any long-term benefit for communities as far as employment goes. Yes, the labor people, the construction people, they get a paycheck for a while, but it doesn't take that long to put up a stadium anymore. So that's a short-term thing.
It is a short-term thing.
What about the so-called ripple effect of the economy locally, especially in the Twin Cities area? Will the Viking Stadium appreciably pump more money?
Not really. No, I mean, sports is really, not just in Minnesota, but across the country, an incredibly small percentage of the economy. Best estimates are it's about 1% of any local economy.
Mm-hmm.
That if we do some kind of comparisons, we have more people who visit museums, libraries, parks, than we do visiting sports facilities. And when we think about it also from an equity point of view, you know, we're looking at, I think I saw some estimates, and that the cost, for example, for the Vikings, the average cost for a family of four to go attend a football game is about $400, if not more. By the time you add in, you know, the ticket prices, parking, you know, a Coke, couple of hot dogs, and things like that, that's not entertainment for the average person.
That's impossible for some people.
It is impossible.
They can't afford it.
It is impossible. And now look at again the seating licensing fees that are going to be charged. You know, Ziggy Wolf's going to charge, you know, in some cases up to $10,000.
Is this season ticket holders?
Yes. And so we're going to be looking at season ticket holders who are also going to be now, you know, paying just astronomical amounts. This is not for the average person. Professional sports has really become more for sort of corporate sponsors than anything else. But the point, as I'm going to say, is that you can't make the argument on economics for professional public subsidies for sports stadiums. If you want to make the argument in terms of saying it's one of several cultural amenities for an area, that's a different debate entirely. But even there, you know, people want to say, well, if you lose a sports stadium or lose a sports team, we become a second-class city. Well, somehow, to use analogies here, I don't think the Twin Cities became second-class when the Lakers left to go to Los Angeles. I'm from New York. Mm-hmm. New York didn't become second-class when the Dodgers and the Giants left. And the same thing, cities don't become second-class or first-class because of sports teams. It's really about an ensemble of packages in terms of, again, libraries, quality of life, jobs, schools, a whole bunch of different things. In fact, if I were to make the argument, and I would make the argument because the evidence supports it, one of the single best investments that a community can make in terms of economic development and in terms of quality of life, well-funded, strong schools.
Ah, okay, called education.
Education. Okay. And I'm not saying is it just because of an educator.
Right.
The numbers bear that out.
Say, this segues nicely into an op-ed piece I saw in the Star Tribune this past week, written by Paul Olson, formerly of the Blandon Foundation, from the president.
Good organization,
yes,
by the way.
Yes, it is indeed. He just got back from many days in Canada, and he visited Ottawa, the capital, of course, the capital city of the nation, and Montreal and Quebec City. And he said, among other things, these cities do not boast major league sports with billion-dollar stadiums built at public expense. Rather, it's clear to see that the public dollars have flowed into countless improvements to make city life attractive for people. This sounds revolutionary, but it's so simple. For example, in Montreal, the canal that once brought supplies into the city is now a favorite boating experience for thousands. And in the winter, the canal freezes and so forth and so forth and so forth. It's just these amenities for people, not just sports fans. And nobody's against sports. I mean, Canada's hockey crazy.
That's
They have their hockey pavilions, and they love them.
And I was going to say, the Montreal Canadiens, one of the great hockey teams of all time.
Love to watch them. The Public Works Department in Canada in those cities, says Olson, are the unsung heroes. You see very little trash or graffiti. Street corners are clearly marked for safety. Nor do you see drivers talking on cell phones. Why? Because it'll cost you $350 on the spot.
Yeah.
So, I mean, these folks here in Canada's not perfect. We're not.
Right.
Olson's not saying that. We're not saying it. But they do have a different set of priorities here, and it's all directed at the people, I think, huh? Yeah.
It is. It is. And I think if you point to cities, Vancouver, Canada, you point to Montreal, Ottawa, even Toronto, although Toronto also has a baseball team. But for all those cities, they're generally ranked by almost all studies across the world as in the top 10, top 20 cities in the world. I mean, really great world class. And as that article points out, it's about the investments in quality of life. Again, going back to my previous life, as I told you, city director of code enforcement, I used to always say that you should be able to run for office in any city in the United States and run on the basics. Fire, police protection, good roads, good sidewalk, keeping the parks clean, you know, picking up the bad guys, putting out the fires, things like that, and schools. That's the core of what makes community strong. What people want for neighborhoods is to be able to walk around the corner to the coffee shop, to go around to a restaurant, to a bookstore, to go to a park, feel like their kids can go out and go play. And that's where the best investments are. It's old-fashioned in terms of infrastructure investments, but those are the best returns on investment, not just economically, but culturally. I mean, rarely have I ever heard anybody say, I'm going to move to the Twin Cities because they have great sports teams. You hear them say, I'm going to move to the Twin Cities because of why? The jobs are here. They're going to say the parks are here. They got good schools. I mean, that's why people are here. That's why people move. They don't move. And it's probably a small bit do. But people don't move because of sports. They move because of the quality of life generated by providing the basic amenities.
David Schultz, the cynics will say, and apparently there are a fair number of them out there, saying that special interests run this country now. They shovel tons of money into the pockets of members of Congress, both parties, and members of the legislature here in this state and others, both parties, the special interests, so-called lobbyists, whatever you want to call it, they are the ones with the loudest voice and the most persuasion, and they get what they want. What about that?
They generally do, in the sense that what we really do see, and I've studied money and politics for many years, and I have a new book coming out, actually end of this year, on democracy and election law. It's all about money and politics. And what I've argued is that what money does in the system in terms of political contributions. It's like a Cold War escalation. One side gets money, it forces the other side to get money, and what it does is both the Democrats and Republicans, and I stress both parties then, have their interest groups that are giving money to the respective parties that then harden their interests and harden their positions in place. And connecting back to what we started our story with today is that part of the gridlock in Congress is the fact that both parties are being financed by their respective interest groups, sending them money, saying, don't give in, don't give in, don't give in, and it hardens positions that make it difficult to negotiate. And that's what we see happening also across a lot of policy areas, that we've really sort of ossified or frozen because of the role of money in politics.
Wasn't always that way. I mentioned at the outset of the show today to read your book and another one, this one by Tom Berg, and you have read it. You've given it high, high praise.
I've done a review for it. It's an amazing book.
Minnesota's Miracle is called. Learning from the Government That Worked. This was the 1971 Minnesota legislature when they compromised. When Republicans sat down with Democrats, Democrats sat down with Republicans. They put their best ideas on the table to equalize our unequal tax formula then, and raised income taxes, lowered property taxes. That helped education, the whole thing. It's a splendid, reading, actually a salient event in the history of our state, where you can see where compromise, that C word that's so often missing, really drove some vast improvements that we still have today.
Right, you're right. And I think there's two reasons why we had the compromise. One is the fact that you did have a stronger set of consensus in terms of agreement, again, regarding what government should do and a commitment to wanting to improve quality of life. But the second thing is what this book is great about pointing out is the change in our party structures over the last 30 or 40 years. And not just nationwide, but statewide, the parties look very different. And here's to a couple of quick stories here. You know, one of them, I always love telling the story about Senator David Durenberger.
Oh, yes.
A wonderful friend of
mine.
A wonderful person. Yep. And it was in 2008, early October of 2008, I was giving a talk at St. Thomas. He's a professor over there. And it was a reception afterwards, and we're getting our snacks in the reception line. Mm-hmm. And David turns to me and says, I don't know if I should get my snacks here or my next reception. And I said, Senator Durenberger, where's your next reception? And he said, at a Barack Obama fundraiser. And I almost dropped my plate. And
wow.
I looked at him and
wow.
I said, I'll clean up the language. And I said, what the heck are you doing going to a Democrat fundraiser? And he said, I'm going to that fundraiser because there's no room in my party for him anymore. Mm. And the reason why I say that story, there used to be a Republican Party that allowed David Durenberger, Tom Horner, and Arne Carlson in it. And there used to be a Democratic Party that allowed for a Rudy Perpich to be in it. Rudy Perpich being a liberal but yes. pro-choice Democrat. Mm-hmm. I mean, pro-life Democrat.
Yes, yes, yes.
You would not find either that anymore. You don't have any conservatives in the Democratic Party, no liberals in the Republican Party, so you don't have this mix that makes it possible for compromise. So we've got this polarization of parties along with the partisanship and along with this huge dissensus or disagreement on why government, which is why the Minnesota miracle mm-hmm. is not possible now, and why this book is so good, because yes. it points to a different era when different conditions existed.
Right. Wonder if we can get back to that, ever get back to that. I don't know. I do know that Tom Berg's book, I believe the publisher, who was it? Somebody bought up enough copies to give a free copy to every member of the last legislature.
That's right.
In the hopes that they would read it and digest it and learn from it. How many members do you think read it? That's a rhetorical question, David.
Not many.
Not many? Okay.
The publisher might have been better off picking up the book and hitting every legislator with it.
I want to do a disclaimer here because part of your book, too, is about, well, we talked about ignorance on the part of some lawmakers, some elected, some appointed officials of our government. Then there's those of us members of the electorate.
Right.
And my disclaimer is the more I try to read and find out, the more I realize how little I know and how much more I have to learn. So that being said, and I mean that, the level of public ignorance among all of us when it comes to understanding our government, understanding our Constitution, understanding how things work.
It's huge also. One of my former teachers many years ago, Michael Della Carpini, did a wonderful book called What Americans Don't Know About Politics and Why It Matters. And he goes through all about the basic stuff that we just don't know. And I'm willing to say it's not important to know all the facts out there.
Right.
But it's important to understand process. It's understand some basics, how a bill becomes a law, things like that.
Well, you mentioned him and from his surveys, and mind you, these are from 1989, I think.
Right,
so
right.
Maybe things have changed for the better, we don't know. But the last we have here, the surveyors found barely 40% could define the Bill of Rights. Over 40% did not know that the Supreme Court could declare laws unconstitutional. Only 20% could name two First Amendment rights. And only 19% could name all three branches of the federal government.
Right. And I suspect it hasn't changed much. There was a great skit done on late night television a few weeks ago where they hit the streets and asked people what they thought of Obamacare. And most people thought it had been repealed or thought it was horrible. Then they asked people, what do you think of the Affordable Care Act? And they said they liked it. And so that points to exactly that situation that we seem to be woefully ignorant. And partly what we have now is also not just legislatures polarized, but we have a polarized society in many ways where we have MSNBC versus Fox. We have people who get their own facts from their own side. And we also have what I call Facebook facts. Not real facts, but things that are appearing on Facebook that we think are true and they're not.
And kids who get their political knowledge from The Daily Show. Satirical send-ups.
Exactly.
Of what's going on. That's
exactly.
Their base. I laugh, but I'm not. I'm crying.
Oh, yes.
I mean, wow. Amazing.
That's right.
David, in our concluding seconds here, we only have, about a minute or two, George, left here. Let's go back to where we started, ending these twin stalemates. What's the scenario? What do you think is going to play out here?
Scenario gets right around to the 17th of October. We roll the extension of government, a reopening of government, into some kind of extension of the debt deal or a debt limit. Okay. It'll be short term. I'm guessing no more than getting us into right before the 2014 elections. I'll go out on a limb and say that it will also include something in terms of repeal of the medical device tax as some way to kind of grease the skids. And
that Obama has to give something.
He's going
to
give. That's what he's going to give on that one. But it's not going to be at all about Obamacare in the end, except for that. That way the Republican can say they got something on Obamacare, which is the repeal of the medical device. And so that's the contour that I'm starting to see. And also we'll probably see some playing around with undoing some of the sequestration, because even some of the Republicans don't like some of the things that happened from sequestration from a year ago, especially when it comes to military spending.
David, should we be worried about our country?
I think so. Yeah. I think so. I'm generally an optimist in life.
I know you are.
But I worry about the fact that, again, we're going to, if I had that sound of the can being kicked down the road again, or the Band-Aid being pulled off again, you know, we're doing a lot of Band-Aid stuff. We're doing a lot of kicking the can at this point. And we're not really addressing the really tough structural questions that we need to address. And if we start to look at a whole bunch of indices across the world, you know, we're slipping in terms of our relative ranking, in terms of education, in a whole bunch of different things. We really do have to be thinking about those investments for the future. If not for us, it's for our kids' sake.
David Schultz, professor of political science and law and business at Hamline University in St. Paul. His latest book, he's got another one coming, but American Politics in the Age of Ignorance. You can find it on Amazon.com, right? And the new book's went out when? We got to get you back.
It'll be
one.
Out in January, and it's going to be called Election Law and Democratic Theory.
Okay. It sounds very academic, but I'm sure it's written in English that we can all understand.
It is.
David. Okay. Welcome back. Thank you so much for coming down here with your cold and your shortage of sleep. And, well, we're getting a little stretch here. So, David, what's on your agenda for you now? Are you back to the classroom on Monday?
I am back to the class on Monday. I'm teaching two great classes, but one of the classes I'm teaching is on generational politics. And I've become interested in the question over the last few years of how do different generations view the political process, and more importantly, how is the generation coming up, the millennials, how might they in 20 years change the political system?
Well, I don't know if I'd change places with them. What do they ask you in the classroom? What's on their mind these days, the young ones?
Well, what they're asking me is, I'll rephrase it and say, in some ways, they are asking the same questions that your listeners are listening to, are talking about. They're concerned about Social Security. They're concerned about jobs. They're concerned about raising a family.
Even those in their 20s, the late teens, are worried about Social Security already.
Yep, they are.
They really are. That's a healthy sign, I think. I'm glad they're concerned about it, because they should be. David, thank you so much.
Anytime. Have me back anytime.
I will. Indeed, I will. Thank you, David Schultz from Hamline University. George, we're out of time. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening. Catch us Monday at noon for the All Request and Dedication Lunch Hour. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.